Okay, is everybody ready?
If you want to record some silence, I'll stop eating the banana.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's record some silence. That was more than enough silence. It's excellent.
And with that silence recorded, let's kick on. Oh, hang on, should we do the shower first?
Okay. Three, two, one.
Ciao!
Right, now that we've recorded some silence and all said ciao so that Graham can synchronise the recordings later, let's crack on with recording the Linux Voice podcast, Series 3, Episode 17. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And together we are Linux Voice in today's Linux Voice podcast. We've got news, we've got a halfway reminder. That's wrong, isn't it? We've got Fines of the Fortnight, we've got Neurons, and we've got a voice of the masses. Oh, that's right. We've brought the halfway reminder forward so that this time it might actually be at halfway.
We've had complaints that joke's getting tired now, you know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But people don't realise it's not a joke.
It's just the truth that some people find funny and now people don't find it funny anymore. It's not a joke that's getting tired. It's just reality. Live with it, people.
We really mean to get it in there halfway through and I don't know what happens.
Oh, well. Anyway, enough of failure. Moving on to success, we've got a brand new section in today's podcast.
We
do indeed. Tell us yeah, in fact, this is replacing Vocalize Your Neurons, and it's called Get on Your Ogbox. So let's not say anything more about it now, but tempt everybody to listen until the end.
That sounds superb. If you listen to this podcast and you like the sound of it and would like more of it in written format, you can go to shop.linuxvoice.com and subscribe to our magazine, which is also very cunningly called Linux Voice. We're also available in WH Smith, and we're going to be everywhere soon. Next issue, we're going to be in Tesco's and, I don't know,
Asda,
Sainsbury's. Yeah, it's our bid to take over the world and be basically the next Murdochs. All four of us. A quad Murdoch. Ben can be Rebecca Brooks because he's a redhead. All feisty.
Could I be David Cameron? Oh, sorry. He's not involved.
I'll be the police horse. And with that, let's move on to the news.
Okay, first up in this fortnight's news, where should we start? Let's start with the top of the list, with the Xor DDoS botnet. This is a sort of virusy type thing infecting Linux machines and using them to launch DDoS attacks. It's quite a ferocious network. It's recorded speeds of up to 150 gigabits a second, which is enough to take off even a fairly sizable server, really. And lots of people, you know, lots of media organizations have put their arms up in the air and gone, ah, Linux is terrible, there's this botnet. But of course, it's not really Linux's fault, because Linux is perfect and never does anything wrong. It's just those pesky server administrators using insecure SSH passwords. So basically, once it's infected one machine, it'll scan the internet looking for other servers. And when it finds one with open SSH ports, does a big brute force attack to try and get in there and spreads that way. And it's been fairly successful. The moral of the story is if you're going to use a password as SSH, first of all, don't. But if you do, use a very secure password. It's a much better option to use certificates if you can.
We're going looking at that XKCD comic where you're supposed to choose a password like correct horse battery staple. Mm-hmm. I've always wondered about that. That's still made up of words in a dictionary. If everybody starts using words like that, okay, it's a long password, but is it not still susceptible to dictionary attacks?
Yeah, but there's a limit to how many words you can attack. So if you consider a regular character, imagine you just use lowercase letters. So if you do one letter, there's 27 possibilities. If you do two letters, there's 27 times 27 possibilities. Three letters, 27 times 27 times 27 possibilities, etc. Use a long enough password, they multiplies, add up, and you get, well, they multiply up, and you get so many possible permutations that it's impossible to crack.
Okay.
With words, there's about 20,000 reasonably common words in the English language. About 100,000 if you use really obscure ones. So if you use a single word, there's one in 20,000 possible options. Use two words, there's 20,000 times 20,000 possibilities. 20,000 times 20,000 times 20,000, etc. Mm. And the point is, by the time you get to four words, it's more complex than if you've got a string of random letters, but much easier to remember.
Okay, fair point. But I assume a lot of the words that a lot of people will use in one of these word-based passwords would actually be in the top 300 or 500 most commonly used words then.
Yeah, Yoda, beards, hat.
You're going to have to change the password now, Andrew.
Of course. But I bet loads of sysadmins have got correct staple horse battery as their password. Nobody else will have it.
If you picked up an OED, Oxford English Dictionary, just flicked through and picked up words of four different pages, you'd end up with a password that is easy to remember because you're only remembering four things and the human mind finds it easy to remember words. I can't remember random alphanumeric passwords. I've got no chance.
Could I ask you, this is something I've never really understood. I can understand why hundreds of thousands of passwords can be checked against the password file. But with an SSH login, I mean, a single login, it takes a couple of seconds for the password to fail. How does somebody attack a server where you've got to go through 20,000, 100,000 different passwords in a reasonable amount of time?
To be honest, slowly is the only good answer to that. But you can attack a lot of servers simultaneously.
Right, okay. So they just parallelize the internet.
Yeah, and if you've got a server that you've broken into, if it takes 2 years to crack into the server, you're not paying for the bandwidth. What do you care?
So there isn't anything clever going on. They really are just trying one password after another after another.
Yeah.
So is it worth running that, I can't remember the name of it, the ban script that drops an IP address whenever there's so many failed attempts on login?
Fail to ban. Yeah, it's incredibly good. I mean, that usually does, so there's different ways of setting it up, but I believe it just puts in a bigger pause, so it won't let you log in for, say, 5 minutes after three failed attacks. And obviously, the difference between 2 seconds and 5 minutes, if you're slowing down a brute force, is enough to make it completely impractical unless you've used correct horse battery staple.
I've started using randomly generated passwords for most things, but it does mean that I have to have use a password wallet. So, you know, almost everything's in there, which does worry me. Or worries me if somebody gets my GNU PG key or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a good solution, to be honest, unless you want to use one of these two-factor authentication things.
Yeah.
Passwords are always going to be weak. It's just a question of making them as unweak as possible, really.
And do you know what the XOR bit refers to?
I actually don't. I was looking into that this morning. I'm not sure.
I'll Google it.
Okay. You mean DuckDuckGo?
Sorry, yeah. I've been using StartPage, actually, for the last month or 6 weeks.
Okay.
It's good because I just really need to get some Google results. But I often still go back to Google. For whatever reason, Google's still better for some specific searches, especially when you're looking for error messages in build scripts or things like that.
It really does my melon looking for error messages on Google, or flags particularly.
Yeah.
Because if you paste in a flag with a command with two hyphens before it, it gives you everything except the flag you want.
Yeah.
But anyway, next up on our list of news is Fortnight. HP has developed a Linux distribution specifically for network switches. And I'm just switching over so I can read you what they've said in their announcement.
That's exactly what Microsoft did, wasn't it, a few weeks ago?
It is exactly what Microsoft did. Well, except HP have actually released it. Microsoft just developed it and then sort of pretended they hadn't.
Ah.
But HP have this to say. Open source software, with its collaborative community of specialized developers, accelerates innovation and improves the stability of the software platform, providing organizations with a more powerful infrastructure to support their specific business requirements, said Mark Carroll, Chief Technology Officer of HP Networking. The newly formed developer community and Linux-based OpenSwitch network operating system early release code will help developers address the rapidly evolving business and web-scale networking needs of the industry. So although that is mostly marketing speak, it shows that, well, it's good to see big company. I mean, this isn't the first time a big company has really gone out there and talked about how great open source software is, but it's always good to hear.
Well, especially when they could have been plugging HPUX for this role, but I suspect that's gone now.
Yeah. And it's also interesting to see this sort of change in the network switch industry. Obviously, you said Microsoft was doing it the other week, and now HP, and it's all about creating incredibly configurable switches to allow you to define networks on the fly and switch stuff around and do all sorts of fancy data structure stuff that I don't really understand. Let's get down into the kernel for our next bit of news.
Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
Hash Gamergate. Oh.
Fart.
Sarah Sharp, the USB 3 driver maintainer for the Linux kernel, has stepped down from her role, and she has this to say. I finally realised I could no longer contribute to a community where I was technically respected but could not ask for personal respect. I could not work with people who helpfully encourage newcomers and send patches and then argued that maintainers should be allowed to spew whatever vile words they needed in order to maintain radical emotional honesty. I did not want to work professionally with people who are allowed to get away with subtle sexist or homophobic jokes. I feel powerless in a community that had a code of conflict without specific list of behaviours to avoid in a community with no teeth to enforce it.
I mean,
okay, next news story.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mike.
A lot of this goes down to Linus Torvalds' behaviour on the mailing list, where occasionally he flips out and hurls abuse at someone, primarily about their code. It must be said, it's not a personal abuse, but it's a lot of the time it's completely over the top and it's directed at senior developers who Torvalds expects better from. So there's sort of two sides to this. Some people are saying, well, yeah, you've got to man up on the kernel mailing list. People are going to be brutally honest about each other's code. And then there's like what Sarah Sharp's saying, that, well, maybe we can get a lot of this done without constantly screaming at each other and throwing insults. This has kicked off a lot of discussion on the internet. And then Matthew Garrett has sort of said something similar, hasn't he? He's sort of backing off from his work on the kernel because of this sort of toxic community.
Matthew Garrett, who we interviewed in the issue that's currently available of Linux Voice.
Did you put him up to this? did you ask him to create some sort of news?
her post is very sensible. It talks about... it's taken 9 months for her to extract herself from the kernel contribution ecosystem. You know, she was part of the Linux kernel summits. The USB 3 subsystem is obviously really important. It's taken her a long time, a long sobering time to extract herself from the community. And this isn't something like overnight you feel... this makes me angry, I'm going to quit. I can understand it both ways. I think I don't want to be sitting on the fence. I think this is something maybe we should, you know, come down one side or the other. But in some ways, I really like the refreshing acerbity of the Linux kernel mailing list and the way that Linus deals with people. But genuinely, the other side, when it's putting off people with such incredible talent as Sarah and Matthew Garrett, then it really needs to be looked at, and I think probably needs to be done differently.
But that's assuming that corporate speak... I mean, no, hang on. We've all worked in workplaces that were full of corporate speak, but which were also completely unprofessional. There's no, you know... All that, you know, courtesy and personal courtesy is, and not swearing is just a basic degree of professionalism. And obviously, a lot of people aren't professionals on the Linux kernel mailing list; they're volunteers. But you don't need to be rude to people to get things done.
Another issue that comes up often with this is people expect that sort of banter, if you could call it, from Linus Torvalds. Occasionally he'll flip off and swear a bit, but again, try and keep it all about the code rather than the person. But then other Torvald's wannabes try and emulate his style, but don't get it. They don't get his sort of humor or the fact that he can do that as the Colonel boss for 20 years and everybody knows him. It's like, oh, look at me. I'm going to be just like Linus Torvalds by calling somebody an XYZ. And then that just turns the entire mailing list into a sugar storm.
Yeah. And I think it's also a throwback from how this all started. You know, Linux is now too big, really, for it to have this kind of system at its core.
Banter. Curse of the modern age.
Yeah, you should see our language when we're off air. So, I mean, and the Matthew Garrett thing does seem slightly different. I think he's done a good thing in appearing to throw his lot in with Sarah and giving us some moral support. But I was reading through the comments on Matthew Garrett's blog, and I can't find it immediately, but it was somebody who linked to Conway's Law. Organizations which design systems are constrained to produce designs which are copies of the communication structures of these organizations.
Snappy. Sorry, Graham, yeah. That wasn't a criticism of you. It was just, you know, some laws are better than others.
No, but if it's going to be this pot of acid, that, you know, if you need to jump into a pot of acid to be able to make kernel contributions, what is the overall output going to be like? You know, what could it be like? What potential are we missing with people like Sarah not being able to contribute anymore?
Yeah, and this also brings me back to a point Leonard Puttering made in when we interviewed him about a year ago. He's saying that some people get used to this. Some geeks in the West get used to this behavior on mailing lists and shouting at each other, whereas in some cultures, losing face publicly, like on a mailing list, and everybody's not just saying your work is bad, but really laying into you, it's, you know, I think in some Asian countries, that is really, really difficult to process.
But nothing's going to happen. It's going to be very difficult to make something change, I think.
It'd be nice if there was a fork of the kernel to like a friendly fork.
Well, I couldn't quite make it clear from Matthew Garrett's blog post. Was that what he was doing? Because he's posted a complete tree of the Linux kernel with some extra patches in it.
Yeah, because he was talking about BSD system levels or something that he's obviously tried to implement in the Linux kernel and has met with resistance. And so he's thought, well, I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah, it's BSD secure level, isn't it? Right. And he's made a source code tree available. I think when people now running around saying, oh, he's forked the kernel as if he's setting off his own project and challenging Torvalds, I don't think that's the case. But yeah, he wants to get this code out there regardless.
And I know Andrew's met Matthew as well, and unfortunately I've not met Sarah, but to have people like Matthew, who is one of the brightest people I've ever met, not being part of this great project of ours is a failure.
Right, listeners, well, I'm going to lift the veil of mystery on the podcast for a moment. Graham's audio has been cutting out, so I think we should all just record ourselves saying, yeah, Graham. Oh, that's a very good point, Graham. just now. So I'll kick off. Graham, you're so right.
I completely agree with you, Graham.
Oh, great. I'm going to make some comments about Gamergate and then cut those bits in.
No, we've got to balance that out a bit then. Graham, you're totally wrong about this.
Oh my God, Graham, that's disgusting.
Graham, you're fired.
Put your clothes back on.
Excellent. Emancipation.
Should we move swiftly on to happier news?
Yeah, news, more news, bring it news. On.
Happier news. Raspberry Pis, lots of them. Well, a few of them. Anyway, have left the Raspberry Pi Foundation and are heading to the European Space Agency to be ready. Ooh. Well, they're already readied for launch. They need to be readied for going in ships to be launched. Anyway, these are part of the Astro Pi competition that went around schools in the UK over the summer, inviting students to submit projects which could be run on these Pis from the International Space Station after they're launched on the 15th of December. You can have a look at the winning entries on the Raspberry Pi blog, but a couple of my favourites were, there's a project using the cameras to measure plant health. You can do something with colour corrections that confused me but seemed interesting. There was one that is it's a simple reaction times game, which sounds fairly trivial in of itself. But the idea is that the astronauts run it at predefined periods over their space flight, and you can see how the stress and things of being in space and looking down on the insignificance of humanity's achievements affects your reaction time. So if your reaction time slows down when you go into the heavens and realize there is no God. And another one that used various sensors to measure things about the system, the ecosystem on the ISS. And then it was going to log all that, so when it came back to Earth, they could upload it into Minecraft and make a Minecraft model with somehow, I don't know how accurate you can make things in Minecraft, which bits are lava, which bits are obsidian, that sort of thing, of the ISS in Minecraft.
So how many pies are they sending to the ISS?
I believe it's two pies, but seven projects to be sort of shuffled between them in some way.
Okay.
It's good. It's great if it's captured the imagination, as I'm sure it has, of the people that entered the competition.
Yeah, and it generally seems like there's some interesting stuff going up. I mean, I'm sure no revolutionary science is going to come of it, but it's not just a token effort, I don't think. It's something that you can actually get your teeth into. And a lot of them are recording data that's going to be made publicly available that you can sort of play with at your will.
Excellent.
We look forward to hearing the results of that. And our final item of Linux news this fortnight is ZFS is coming to standard Ubuntu. We don't really know many details about this at the moment, but Lord Shuttleworth, Archduke of Ubuntu, has decreed that it will come and will be available.
Well, he's not going to fork it first and create UFS.
Quite possibly, I don't know.
But yeah, he said it's going to be available as standard in Ubuntu, which some people have interpreted as meaning the default file system, which we don't know yet, and I doubt. I don't really know much about file systems. I mean, they're not the hottest of topics, but it's quite good to see all this competition development going on in BTRFS, or is it ButterFS? How are we supposed to pronounce it?
It's BTRFS, because butter is no shorter. And just, if you're going to call anything, call it BTRFS, which is what it is. And ButterFS is exactly the same length to say, but inaccurate, whereas BTRE is exactly what it is and the same length as the acronym.
But when I spoke to its lead developer at the time, Valerie Aurora, she said it's ButterFS.
Did you take the time to point out that she's wrong?
ButterFS is shorter than what?
No, BTRFS takes the same time to say as ButterFS. They're not what, but BTRE is what it is, and butter is some word made out of the acronym for BTRFS.
I can't believe it's not ButterFS.
I can't believe it's not BTRFS.
I think Ben should make his own podcast about this.
It's like when people call four-wheel drive 4WD. You haven't saved any time in saying that. You've just made it more obscure. So yeah, the thing about ZFS is it just seems so pointless, this whole thing about modern file systems, when it's all come down to the fact that the particular open source license on ZFS isn't compatible with a particular open source license in the kernel. One's a CDDL and one's a GPL. And if we could just sort that nonsense out, all this re-implementation and shuffling around and all, let's do that, would be just entirely pointless. And we could all just use the best file system for the job and not worry about any of this nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the FreeBSD crew really rave about ZFS.
Yeah, it's a good file system, and it does work on Linux. It's ZOL, ZFS on Linux, that you can install in most distros. And that'll give you access to ZFS. And you can do that, and you don't have to go around shouting at people that it's pronounced BTFS, not ButterFS.
It may be ZFS.
It makes everything a lot simpler. And that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent. Thanks for that utterly non-contentious news. Okay, so it's time for finds of the fortnight. I've got to go and get something from downstairs that's part of my find. If somebody wants to share their find first, I'll go and get it.
Ooh, well, I did ask the IRC channel, so I can take over that role. Somebody says MB, Twisted Lucidity says MB, which appears to be a free software alternative to Plex, so a media player. McPhail pointed out KiltedCamel.com Defend the Highlands, a tower defense game based in Scotland with lots of stereotypes of Scottish, British and Welsh, Irish people, bad voice acting. And that was it, actually, from the IRC channel.
What was the one that was the open source Plex?
EMBY. I don't even know what Plex is. Do you know anything about that, Ben?
Yeah. Plex is kind of like a media streaming server. I've only used it very briefly myself. I think Graham might use it, actually. But it's quite popular, even for people who want to have a sort of a video server locked away in their basement and then stream it through. I'm not sure if you can use it with XBMC or that sort of thing.
You're talking about Plex?
Yeah. Or MB, as somebody mentioned on the IRC channel. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I saw that come up on IRC. Yeah, it's a really... Plex itself is brilliant, but it's parts of it are proprietary and you have to pay for it.
Yeah. And if anybody else is interested, it's #LinuxVoice on chat.freenode.net, where we're all hanging out. Then I'll move on to my finds, which both of them have been emailed to me again this episode. So thanks, everybody. HEGX64 says, great podcast. Here is an extremely useful find. Python-M simple HTTP server. It starts a web server in the current directory on port 8000 with no installation required. You can also give a port as an argument. It's useful to quickly share files with a phone or a Windows computer on your network. Also, the Wikipedia page List of Lists of Lists is rather amusing. And it is. I don't need to say anything more about that, but just go and visit it. Then, the second find.
So, can I just jump in quickly? And the Python-M simple HTTP server is really useful, but also if you're running servers, it can be quite a big security hole because it makes it very easy if you can sort of run a command on someone's server, you can just start that and use it to pull off whatever files that should have been protected by PHP and that sort of thing. So it's just something to be aware of.
Okay.
That way.
And Greg Thompson says, I recently needed to compare two rather long config files for version changes. Visually scanning them wasn't an option. I didn't feel like dealing with diff at the command line. A quick Google turned up meldmerge.org. What a fantastic utility. It's like gedit and diff on steroids. In no time at all, I was able to merge the old bits that mattered with the new version of the config. I'm adding this to my list of must install apps. Fantastic, and I love the podcast. Thanks, Greg. Those are my pre-supplied finds.
Well, shall I go next? Because I've got a pre-supplied find as well. Somebody, in fact, it was Nils Werner. He tweeted at me a find, and it's really cool. It's called Zget or Zget, and it's basically simple zero-conf-based file transfer. So really, if you're sat next to somebody and you just want to send them over a file, it's best just to give you an example. So the zput holidaypics.zip on one machine, and then on the other machine, the other person types zget holidaypics.zip, and everything else is worked out automatically, and the files are transferred.
How?
I don't know. I've not looked into it, but I mean, I guess when the put command's running, it's looking for the other service on the net, and then when the other service pops up with the get, it finds it. No authentication or anything like that, other than the file name being the same, and it just grabs it.
Seems pretty fancy.
Yeah, I think I do need to do something like that quite often in the house.
Yeah, all the time.
So that's a great find. Thanks, Nils. Another one came up on Hacker News a couple of days ago, and I've moaned about email clients before on the next, and this was the N1 email client. I don't know if you've seen it, Nihilus N1. It's an open source email client and also a back end to get over some of what the developers see as shortfalls in IMAP. But what the user interface, and I've not tried it, looks perfect. It looks exactly what I want. It's got threaded conversations on the right. It's very clear and concise. It supports labels and all that kind of stuff that can get a bit awkward when dealing with IMAP. The back end is also open source, so there's nothing particularly stopping you running on your own server, which, or even on the same machine as the client. So I'm going to try and get that running. Another thing is that I found this comic that I used to read, right? This is from January the 22nd, 1983. And this comic's called Spike. It's the first edition of a comic called Spike that didn't last very long. But what I...
That was just before my first birthday.
Well, there you go. You got a free Super Swooper glider on the front. I can really remember it. So, but what I thought was interesting, I was browsing through this the other day, as I do, because I spend my life wallowing in nostalgia. There's this small paragraph in the letters page called Computer Bore. So this is from January 1983. As more and more people buy computers, perhaps your family has one, the day comes closer when every household will have one. The home computer of tomorrow will be linked to phone and TV and will be able to be used for writing letters, ordering your shopping, booking your holiday, or simply playing games, an all-purpose tool which will make it unnecessary for you to ever leave the house. What a bore.
I thought... That's that. That's actually scarily accurate of what I do on my computer. Yeah,
me too, which is why I thought that's a great prediction, you know, for 30 years or whatever it is. And then my final find is that I've been trying to fix that ARM board that I mentioned I broke a couple of weeks ago. I haven't been able to do it, but one of the ways I was trying to troubleshoot its bootloader and see if I could get things fixed was to use, there's a UART. There's a series of UART pins, a basic serial port, and I haven't got a machine with a serial port on it anymore to be able to connect to the UART port pins on the ARM board. But the Raspberry Pi has. I didn't know this.
I was just about to say you do have.
Yeah. Well, I didn't. I thought surely the Raspberry Pi must have something. In fact, the Raspberry Pi's got two because it's got some on the Broadcom chips as well, on the Broadcom pins as well. But two of the GPIO pins on the Raspberry Pi operate as UART for a very simple serial connection, if people remember serial ports back in the old days. Basically, you wire up the TX on one side to the RX on one side and the RX on one side to the TX on the other and make sure ground is connected between them both. And then, you know, then you bring up a simple, you know, terminal emulator or Minicom. And you can see the text that's streaming from the bootloader or whatever you're happening to debug. It's still quite commonly used. In fact, by default, the Raspberry Pi outputs all of its boot messages across the same UART pins if you ever need to debug the Pi, if the video connectors aren't working, for example. And I actually was able to interact with the ARM board quite a lot, but I've spent so much time on it now, I've just got to move on. But that's really good. If you need to have debug something or connect something to a serial port, the Raspberry Pi has got the capabilities of doing it. It's really easy. And they're my finds.
Yeah, I had to do something similar, actually. Did I use a Raspberry Pi? No, I didn't. I did it on my laptop. I had to sort of a UDO's bootloader using the serial connection into it. Can't for the life of me remember how I did it now.
So did you use, has your computer got a RS-232 serial port on it?
No.
Or you can get the FTDI drivers for USB devices.
I think I did use an FTDI. I can't remember.
And then they behave like a serial port anyway, so you can do it that way.
Yeah. In fact, I might have streamed it through an Arduino.
That sounds more complicated. That sounds like you'd have to write something, you know, to deal with the input on the pins and translate that back into the board rates.
No, there's There's a serial driver, like a library for the Arduino. Yeah, it's a serial port that you over USB that you usually communicate through.
Of course,
and I'm pretty sure you can just link it in. In fact, you might just be able to plug them into the TX and RX pins on the Raspberry Pi and the Arduino. I can't remember.
Okay, but it is useful.
Yeah. And doesn't that mean you could have debugged it using MicOS?
Yeah. Oh, Mike wasn't there at the time. He was gone to get another banana.
Are you putting your casserole in the oven?
He's gone to get another beer.
Oh, poor Mike.
So that leaves Ben and Andrew, if either of you want to have a go.
Shall I go next?
Yeah.
I've got a few finds this fortnight. And I'll start with the annoying one. We've recently moved house, got the internet set up, etc. And everything was fine for sort of a couple of weeks. And then I suddenly found the internet just crashed to a halt. The data was getting through, but incredibly slowly. Sort of, I say incredibly slowly, about half a mega second, which obviously 5 years ago I'd have been delighted with. But now it seems interminably slowly. And I sort of tried to work it out. I got onto ISP support team going, what's going on? This is rubbish, etc., etc. Turned out it was a driver issue in Ubuntu. I use a USB Wi-Fi dongle type thing. And it turns out that it was an issue. It was plugged into a USB 3 port. And when I moved it to a USB 2 port, it worked fine. And the speed came back up. Now, I'm not saying this is caused by Linux being rude to USB 3 kernel maintainers and scaring them off. But it does seem a bit of a coincidence. I have no idea what caused it, but it's all working fine.
Did it cause a problem on the router?
Not that I'm aware of. I couldn't find any errors in any logs anywhere. It just ran slowly.
But it ran slowly just on your laptop? Other machine.
I'm a desktop.
Right. And support were able to help you with that.
No.
I was going to say.
I can't even remember why I tried it. To be honest, I think it was just. In fact, I know why I tried it. It's because I tried unplugging it and plugging it back in, and the USB 3 ports on the back and the USB 2 ports on the front. So I unplugged it from the back and then put it back into the easiest one, which was USB 2.
Maybe Sarah's left more in the kernel than people think.
Yeah. Right. My next discovery. This isn't really a find so much as something that's been gradually building up to the point at which I'm cracking. I've decided to, after many, many years of loyalty to Firefox as a browser, I'm switching. It's got too bad in recent releases. It's too slow. It's not fundamentally slow, but it just keeps, when you've got a lot of tabs open, it just can't handle it. One tab can take down the whole browser, and it's just not feasible for me to keep using it anymore. It's a major tool that I use, and it's got to the point where a few times a day now I will have an issue with the performance of Firefox.
So what are you switching to?
I think Chrome or Chromium, probably Chromium.
But then you're part of the botnet, aren't you? You can't do that.
I will be part of the botnet, but there's no other option. I need a decent web browser, and Firefox, for me, no longer falls under the category of decent web browser.
What about this Cupzilla? Didn't Graham mention that a while back? Okay, Cupzilla, or whatever it's called.
Oh, there was the Cupe browser.
Oh, yeah.
But it's not really a replacement for Firefox for lots of things, and it's mostly driven by its Vim key bindings, but it's a great browser. It's sad, but I can understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I do feel vaguely guilty leaving Firefox.
Yeah.
But I still use it on my mobile, but and I haven't completely switched yet. There's all the passwords saved in Firefox. I no longer know what they are.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There are many sites I visit in Firefox, and if I reload them in Chromium, they use up a third of the percent of the CPU for some reason. And it can get frustrating, and Firefox is such an important free software project, and I wish they'd spend more time on these optimizations instead of folding in pocket and other proprietary bits and bobs.
Yeah, it's a real shame because I think there was a point a few years ago where it was technically the better browser. I think it seemed to run a lot faster. It worked really well, and it just seems to have. Maybe it's the web that's changed. Maybe websites are putting more and more into JavaScript now. And now, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's probably no more than 20 or 30 tabs opening the day, and it was consuming 7 gig of memory. And none of them were like web apps or anything like that. They were all just websites. And it's like, how is that a thing?
Yeah. 20 or 30 tabs is quite a few.
It's a few, but it's not 7 gigs worth.
No, no. The web is broken, really.
There's so many ways in which the web is broken. Something's going to give soon, yeah. But who knows? Maybe Apple will be there to save the day when it does. And my final discovery find this fortnight is I might have mentioned this before actually, but I was building I acquired an old 1940s radio with the innards of which are absolutely knackered, and I decided to turn it into a Bluetooth speaker just because it looks quite nice. And I thought, well, there's obviously a few ways you could do this. One is to get a regular Bluetooth speaker, deconstruct it, and put it back together inside the new housing. But I thought, I'll build it from the various modules I can get. So I was hoping to be able to say I've got this all working, but so far the power supply hasn't arrived. But I got it's all driven by a KRC-86B version 4 audio Bluetooth module, which is incredibly simple to use. It's... probably about 1.5 inches by 1.5 inches as a little square. It takes 5 volts of power, and other than that, all the pins are exactly what you'd expect. Yeah, there's a out left, out right, and the ground for that. There's lead plus, lead minus, and that's it. You just wire it up how it says, and it works. You can play Bluetooth through it, play audio through it using Bluetooth.
Wow. And so that's the DAC and everything.
That does, yeah, absolutely everything. You can plug just a small test speaker into it, directly, and it will play fine.
That's really cool.
Yeah. I don't know if you'd have issues if you had more of them, because I don't think you can change the ID of it.
Right.
So if you had, like, two or three of them in the room, I don't know how you'd manage to do it.
But maybe Bluetooth devices have the equivalent of MAC addresses. I don't know. I'm completely ignorant of it.
Yeah, I don't know anything like that. But yeah, that works fantastically. And I've got a little amp as well, but I don't have the power supply for that yet. So, we'll wait and see.
Cool. So I was just going to say you're one step along on the hipster spectrum.
Well, I did also spend part of yesterday poking wires into a 1970s record player to try and use it as an amp for my TV. Which did work, actually, in the end. So thanks for that, Graham. Yeah, help me out with that. And those are my finds this fortnight.
Cool.
Right, here's my find, then. Which just like last fortnight was sent to me by a charitable listener. Because I never have any finds. So here is the find sent by Phil the Sheep. Thanks, Phil. There was a series of short programmes on Radio 4 about the history of computing in Britain. They're only short, but there's some interesting stuff in there. They're available indefinitely, and they may even be accessible globally, as I don't know if the BBC geolocks its podcasts. And there's a link, which we'll supply in the podcast notes. But having clicked through to some of these, there's their travel back to the 1940s to hear the story of the creation of computer memory. Leo, the electric office, the British Lions tea shops that created the first office computer.
Yeah, it was. So, can we do a quick test? See if Mike can download them. See if they are available globally.
Us.
What
over
do I
to
do?
Germany.
Live.
Hello, Germany, can you hear us?
Upper Bavaria.
This is Bluetooth calling.
What am I supposed to be looking for?
So look on the IRC. I've just posted a link there to the BBC iPlayer.
Ah, got you. Let's see. It's loading. It's loading slowly. Available now. 10.
2 points.
So let's
there
see.
There is water on Mars.
Computers at home. Let me click this and see what happens.
Yeah.
Download MP3. Is this going to work? Yes, it works. It works from
it works.
Far distant lands on the other side of Europe.
You mean far distant lands in Europe?
Yeah.
Yes, so there's one here about the pervasive fear that the computer would lead to mass unemployment, and it appears to be illustrated with a photograph of Bob Hoskins, God rest his soul. Yeah, all sorts of stuff. Presented by a person called Hannah Fry, who describes herself as a lecturer in the mathematics of cities. What an awesome name. On her website, there's a picture of her face with the caption, "This is my face." There you go. All the wind you need and more. Thanks, Phil. Thanks for that. That looks really interesting.
It does. It does.
Hang on, what T-shirt are you wearing, Andrew? Since you stood up there.
I'm wearing a pink T-shirt. Let me just... There you go.
Oh, I'll get this in the podcast notes.
Is that Vladimir Putin as the village people?
It is. It's every single one of the village people. I think it's because Putin is such a manly man, you know, he rides bears and all that lot, that he's been... The artist who made the T-shirt decided to put his face onto the manliest of all boy bands, the village people.
You know, the man band.
The man band. He looks great with the moustache of the biker. There he is. And I like the mirrored shades of the... Is that the traffic cop? Oh, no, it's not, is it? Who's he?
He's the construction worker.
He's the construction worker, isn't he? Yeah. Yeah. So there we go. Interlude.
Awesome. Excellent. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for everyone for your finds. Is this halfway?
Yep. Oh god, it is, isn't it? So wearily we trudge towards the halfway reminder, like gorillas in the mist. It looms up towards us, and we can see sketched on the plinth, "Here, look upon my works, ye mighty King of Kings. My name is Ozymandias, and still to come, there's Get on Your Ogbox and Voice of the Masses."
Excellent. Yeah, we had a Vocalise Your Neuron sent to us this episode from Andrew Conway, one of our esteemed writers. But he took a novel slant on it. He sent it in as an OGG file. So here's what he had to say.
"Hello, Linux Voice people. I would like to vocalise my neurons, quite literally, on a subject related to a find that I sent in via Andrew Gregory that you discussed in the last podcast. And that was a mention of Linux in a favourable way in the UK newspaper, The Guardian, in an article by journalist Paul Mason. Now, Linux sits at the heart of what you might call, or at least a key part of what you call, information revolution, starting with the internet, the World Wide Web, and now with mobile handsets. But it's interesting to think of it as a technology, like a new technology that's driving the change. If you go back, say, to the Industrial Revolution, which was a very big revolution, you find the hackers of that age were like the likes of James Watt, who worked in the steam engine, here where I am in Glasgow, actually, Richard Trevithick, down in Cornwall, with a self-propelled steam engine, essentially a car, and finally, the first railway locomotive, at least the most famous, successful, feasible one, that was produced by Stevenson up in the north of England. Now, what's interesting about these three locations, it's not where the money was at, that was probably London even back then. It's not where academic learning was, that was probably Oxbridge even back then. They were there because they were near where mines were, and out of those mines were coming coal and iron and people who understood the technology, and that's why those hackers of that age were there. Forward to 1991, Linus Torvalds sends out that notice, and in that notice announcing that he's working on the operating system, he specifically says a 386AT. Now, this is a PC which, in its day, was really quite affordable. People could afford to bring them into their homes. A lowly PhD student could get a lot of time to play on them in an institution like a university. And that meant that in addition to having free and open source software, you had the resources, the raw materials, like the coal and the iron of its day, for this change in technology to take root. But more than that, it caused a change in investment. Because of the GPL, you then had the situation where you just couldn't just pour money into Linux Inc. There was no real such thing as that. Instead, people ended up in lots of institutions with all kinds of backgrounds feeding code into the kernel. So it could be anything from an employee at Microsoft through to a hacker doing it for fun, working on a shoestring in their bedroom. And that's the beauty of Linux, is it doesn't just change the way of doing free and open source software, it changes the way of doing investment, changes the flows of money, can change the economy, and through the information revolution, along with lots of other technologies, change our society.
Thanks for that, Andrew. anybody got any thoughts?
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I learned something. Have I said this before? But I learned something about... So there's a place in County Durham called Shotley Bridge, which was in the medieval era. It was the centre of steel making and sword making in England, because a bunch of craftsmen from the Guild of Sword Makers in Zollingen in Germany broke their guild vows, went to County Durham and set up shop there. And that was, and Consett became like the big steel making town, not just because it was close to the port of Newcastle for Swedish iron ore, which was superior to English iron ore, and it was near the Durham coalfields as well, and near a water supply, so everything was there, and it remained, it stayed the place in the UK for steel until the invention of the Bessemer converter, which meant that you could use low grade Sheffield ore. And in enormous quantity, so you didn't need to import Swedish ore anymore. Anyway, there you go.
Oh no!
There must be an analog for that in terms of Linux.
System D.
System
Sheffield
D
is the system
enables
D.
Inferior Sheffield code to be mass produced.
Well, this is. I think there's a parallel to that between what Eric S. Raymond writes about in The Cathedral and the Bazaar, about the shift between the sort of the mainframes where you had to write your code on things and you took it into the mainframe maintainers and they took your carefully assembled pile of codes and you dropped it on and it ran, and some days later you'd be presented with a sheet of the results and then you went away, to the sort of interactive style of computing, the PDP 11, I think it was, that really sort of spawned. I think there's definitely a reason that's the machine that Stallman was hacking on when he was working at MIT, and it's a different style of things, and that was where open source in the computing sense was really born, when you had those reels that they kept in the drawers, that you just whipped out whatever you want, you changed them and you put them back. It wasn't your code that you took there, it was just code that sat in the drawer next to the interactive machine.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, thanks a lot for that, Andrew. I thought, let's give this a try. Let's see if anybody else wants to send in their neurons, but as an OGG file. So this section can be get on your OGG box. If anybody wants to email me, mike@linuxvoice.com, with an audio recording, say 2 minutes maximum, nice and clear in OGG format with a good clear microphone, and let us know your musings, your thoughts, your rants, your discoveries. And email them to me and we'll see how it goes.
Is it okay if they send some XML?
No, only JSON now.
Right then, it's time for Voice of the Masses. So free software, it's doing really well since the heady days of GNU and the Free Software Foundation, which is 30 years old. And a bit as of today. Linux obviously is everywhere, including in space and in a million pockets on Androids. However, there's a final frontier, and that is open hardware. There's you know, our choices are extremely limited. We did, Mike reviewed actually a laptop which was completely open, didn't you? What's that all about, Mike?
I did. This will go into Linux Voice issue 21. There are very few laptops or PCs you can buy that are approved by the Free Software Foundation. But the one I looked at in the magazine is the Libre Boot X200, a refurbished ThinkPad, and it's free software right down to the core, right down to the BIOS. They're available from minifree.org. But like I say, read issue 21 for more information.
But that's hardware that runs entirely open source software. That's not open hardware. You can't go get the schematics to that laptop and mess around with it. You can't, you know, change bits on it, not easily.
That's a very good point, Ben, actually. Yeah, there are two sides to that as well. Yeah, you can run fully free software stack on it, but yeah, there's also open hardware where the actual design is open.
Okay, so that leads us on to the question. If you want a computer that's fully free software down to the BIOS, you've only got a handful to choose from. So, should we start fighting for more open hardware? Should we be petitioning vendors to release firmware code under FOSS licenses, or is it a side issue and we should stay focused on software? Let us know your thoughts below. Obviously, below has, you know, as a physical dimension, has no meaning on the radio. Maybe
you should say it like this.
So let's start with Jake. Because in his little avatar photograph, he's looking particularly fly. Jake says, open hardware is necessary to ensure the future privacy and security of users. Running a CPU that contains unverifiable code is tantamount to running a closed binary as root. It's a big single point of failure that requires full trust of the manufacturer. Currently, every computer system requires you to trust the manufacturer, but the less trust that is required, the more trustworthy the company. We should certainly be putting pressure on companies to be as open as possible. I think the security community should be pushing this issue harder than anyone else. Their clients are the ones at risk. They could also supply third-party verification of the firmware.
So this is talking about the microcode that runs on things like Intel CPUs. So an Intel CPU effectively contains its own operating system. So when you send a command in, that doesn't run directly on the hardware. That's interpreted by the software and runs on some separate hardware. And all that sort of, not just closed source, but pretty much closed to all prying eyes in every possible way, or as much as possible. And we have no way of knowing whether or not what it's doing is good or bad. And there's no real way of getting around that with a modern CPU.
Mm. Isn't that something that projects like the Open RISC project would kind of solve? If, admittedly, there's a million years between the capabilities of an Open RISC CPU and something that Intel produces in 2015.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly, yeah. There's Open RISC and Low RISC are both working on, open, truly open CPUs. You know exactly what's going on. Although, to a certain extent, you still have to trust the device manufacturer. You know, you can send them the hardware description of what you want to go on the CPU, but they could be putting anything on there. It's pretty hard to peer inside a chip and see what's actually going on.
I think it is a really important question. I mean, it's the same with phones. For a while, it looked like we'd have quite a few open phones. I think like the Open Moco. And now there isn't really any kind of open phone that you can get hold of, at least one where the firmware running on, the radios are open source. The best you can hope for is that there's a Cyanogen mod or replicant build for your Android phone, but that's not completely free.
No, it's a long way from free, again, because there's things like the baseband chips that run all the radio frequency stuff, and there's not likely to be a free option for those in the near future.
An open hardware, not just in and because of itself, helps us keep the momentum for open source and free software. I remember reading recently that FCC legislation in the US may begin to make it illegal for you to tinker with the firmware on your Wi-Fi router. Because they want to have such control over the radio.
The issue there is they won't just make it illegal to tinker with it. They'll make it a requirement that routers make it difficult to tinker with or impossible.
And that's sad. You know, that's the fact that you can't play with your own hardware with something that's, you know, as useful as a router.
Yeah, it's
So, Animation 1138 says, I didn't see this as a problem until stories came out about the NSA hacked hard drives and Lenovo. Seriously, Lenovo? Seriously? Yeah, it's true. I mean, a lot of esoteric technical things are absolutely boring, cryptic, and non-relevant at all until some sort of crisis occurs or somebody breaches your rights, and then all of a sudden it becomes shockingly relevant. Alex Mayer says, hardware is a different market than software. Software can be produced at no cost other than someone's time. Hardware, on the other hand, has physical costs. For this reason, I don't think open hardware is feasible. With all that being said, I would love nothing more than to know that I'm totally secure from hardware all the way up through my operating system. I'm not holding my breath, though. Dale McGee says, a long, long reply. There is a good point here. The big problem is demand. Unless you can produce a million units, it's very expensive to produce hardware, and this needs to be passed on to the user in order to break even. So you end up with open platforms which are overpriced and under-specced, making them an even more niche product than they would be otherwise. There are a bunch of people out there who would love open hardware, but not so much that they'd accept something which isn't competitive in terms of prices and specs. I don't have an answer. It's a chicken and egg problem.
I think he's completely right about that.
Yeah.
There is some demand. It's not that there's none, and there's people like the Open Risk Project, as Low Risk Project, who think they found the right balance and they can commercially produce open CPUs. We shall see.
But if it's less useful and costs twice as much, then that niche market is extremely small.
It is, but you can take 0.001% of the world CPU market and still have a massive market. I think initially at least it is finding the right area where you can get away with something a bit less powerful, and because you can add on different features as well. So, for example, low risk of putting on the Minion cores, which make and tagged memory, which aren't, I believe, available in commercial processors. Although they're lower in some specs, they have features that aren't available in other areas. And it's finding things like that. I mean, probably the biggest example, the most widely used piece of open hardware is the Arduino. And they're far less powerful than, you know, other microcontrollers. But the openness is a feature, the ease of use is a feature, and all those make them the right fit for a particular niche.
Right. Stephen Williams, it's becoming increasingly apparent that open hardware is going to be crucial to having open software. If we don't have the ability to inspect the firmware or change it, we won't be able to load the software we want to use or guarantee that we are only running what we want to run. I would be willing to take a hit on performance to own open hardware. At the same time, I don't want to be using equipment that is itself used or old, because it is more likely to break down than newer equipment. Francesco Turco says, free hardware, as in freedom, is just as important as free software. Hardware manufacturers should be forced to release schematics, source code written in hardware description language, etc. Proprietary hardware should be banned, just like proprietary software. That's certainly one approach. You could argue that open hardware is better for the consumer, but the chicken and egg market forces solution is an example of market failure. So, banning proprietary hardware is a system of market regulation.
I mean, I think it's quite interesting that this is really the area that patents were created to solve. The principle there was, to get a patent, you had to open your hardware. You had to show exactly how it was made. So I think the terminology was a reasonably competent person in that area could recreate your product, and in reward for doing that, you were given a particular period of a monopoly over the product. I think it was 10 years originally, and that was how they balanced the open and the closed aspects of it 100 years ago, or however long it was. Nowadays we don't have that. We just close everything up and grant patents willy-nilly. But it seems that was actually quite a good solution to the problem. It allowed market forces to work and people to profit from their inventions, but also prevented excessive closing of technology.
Yeah, yeah. The free market can work. It can work, but only under a set of circumstances.
Yeah, it's actually almost linked to what Andrew Conway was talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, how innovation needs to be given the right environment to thrive.
Yeah.
And then you can just chuck it out there and say, go on, lads, get on with it. Yeah. So Jan says, but even if all schematics would be available for free, which would already be a big step, who's got the means to actually make something? Something significant, that is. Only the hardware manufacturers can. Which brings us back to the trust issue. So unless we can print our own CPUs at home, I'm afraid this is still a dream. But who knows? ...
Yeah, you certainly got a valid point there that you need to trust your chip manufacturers. I mean, there are steps around it. You could use FPGAs to implement stuff, but that's obviously going to be a lot slower, and you still have to trust the FPGA manufacturer. Verifiable builds in hardware, as far as I'm aware, there's not a good solution to that.
So the thing that Francesco mentioned, the source codes, the hardware description language, which would go along with open hardware, would that be enough?
Would you be able to trust a manufacturer if they release the hardware description language along with it?
No, it's think about it in open source terms. You could have the source code and say, this is the source code. It's all wonderful and open. But here, run this binary. You don't know for sure that binary's come from that source code. Obviously, you can compile the source code yourself.
Yes.
But in hardware, you can't do that.
Yeah. All right. I understand.
Cool. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for making my brain bigger.
Obviously, you can do some sort of sanity checks. You can make sure that it behaves as you would expect it to had it come from that hardware description language. But there could be nasties hidden in there in clever ways that you just can't tell.
Hmm. Right, that's it. That's the end of the voice of the masses. We've tarried here far too long, like the long parliament before Cromwell threw it out. We must now go and do other things.
I think that was a really interesting discussion, actually. Surprising how important and how little thought of open hardware is. I was going to say we should mention OddCamp because I don't think we've done it yet in the podcast.
No. We have.
Have we?
Yeah, but it's no harm mentioning it again.
So OddCamp, the UK's premier open source maker kind of festival unconference is happening in Liverpool this year at the very end of this month. It's Halloween weekend, October the 31st and November the 1st in Liverpool. I'll put the link in the podcast notes. We've been there the last couple of years. It's really a great thing to go to. A couple of us are planning to go up there as well. So it'd be nice to meet you if you can make it.
And there's going to be... England aren't going to be in the Rugby World Cup final that weekend. So there's no reason not to go.
Yeah, exactly. All the more reason to go along.
Yeah. I was also going to... I thought like the ending with the music was really good last episode. I haven't had a chance to look. I looked very briefly for some CC by SA music produced by Linux that we could use. I couldn't find any. And musicians are very reluctant to not include the non-commercial clause in their Creative Commons stuff. So if anybody wants to send me a link to some music we can use at the end of the podcast, ideally created by Linux or open source tools, I think it'd be a great way to end the podcast in future.
That sounds good.
But cool. As such, yeah, we can play out with Brad Sucks, which is awesome anyway.
Thanks, everybody. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Graham, you're so right.
I completely agree with you, Graham.
Graham, you're totally wrong about this. It's such a nice day.